From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. The last early bird deal of the year is opening today for Kim and Carrie's fabulous keto coaching program. So if you want to get yourself started on your keto journey and don't know where to start, check out the details at start.ketowomanpodcast.com. And you'll also find a happy, healthy keto button on the links page at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's extraordinary woman is Maggie Tukey. Maggie is 68 and lives with her partner in North Yorkshire. She had a secondary school teaching career from 1974 to 1997, punctuated by long leaves of absence to cycle through Europe, South America, Australia and New Zealand to name but a few. In 1989, she was caught up in the Tiananmen Square massacre. In 1999, Maggie began a career in aid work during the war in Kosovo and went on to work in areas of conflict and natural disaster. She now works on the Lebanon-Syria border. I have known Maggie for about 10 to 15 years, ever since I moved here pretty much. As I mentioned at the start of the interview, she was one of the people who leapt into my mind when I started this podcast, because she truly is extraordinary. I have the deepest respect for her and the work she does, and look up to her as a bit of a hero, quite frankly. She is one of those people who loves to help, and she always rolls her sleeves up and helps out with whatever project is going on at the time. She helped me lay my kitchen floor and also had a hand in the decking. She's just one of those people, you know, good, kind, extraordinary. Now here comes the disclaimer. Not all of you are going to like this episode. It's not about keto, not one little bit. It steps into that murky area that people get touchy about. It's political. Not in your typical party leader critical way, but talking about things that are the result of political upheaval and disagreement. If this is territory you don't want to walk through, then I would just skip this episode. If you want to hear a really interesting story from an extraordinary woman who has seen things none of us would choose to see, then stay tuned. Maggie comments on things from her experience, from what she saw on the ground among the people she was helping. She isn't setting out to make any big political statements here, and neither am I. It's an uncomfortable subject at times, but then the people she is talking about are so far from comfortable, I think a little discomfort on our part and something to really get us thinking is no bad thing. Those of you who choose to stay, I hope you enjoy Maggie's story today. You would think, wouldn't you, that mic issues would not happen when I'm sitting across the table from the person I'm interviewing. I'm completely at a loss why there was so much rustling. I can't blame a beard because Maggie doesn't have one. I think possibly the problem is the mic I've been putting on the guests is my mic, which is set up for me. I use it for them because it's the better mic, but I think maybe I have a weird shaped head or something. Anyway, prepare for more mic rustling in this episode, which I hope will not be too distracting. Welcome, Maggie, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Now, we've known each other for a long time, and I have to say that when I started this podcast, I had you in mind to interview because I think people will find your story and what you do really interesting. So going away a little bit from the kind of people I usually interview in that you're not keto, but you're certainly extraordinary. So it's nice to be here and be here with you actually face to face in my living room today here in sunny France. So perhaps you could just tell the listeners a bit about you.
Oh, where to begin, really? The job I've had for the last 18, 19 years was, I suppose, a total change of direction for me, because before that, I'd been a teacher in a secondary modern school in North Yorkshire for 20-some years, I suppose, something like that. And I decided, although I loved the job, and I really did love the job teaching, it was great, lots of challenges, but I decided it was time to go, really. One year, and I was cycling through Europe on a summer holiday, and I just decided that I wasn't going to go back to teaching that September, and I'd already got my notice written out, and I submitted it from Slovenia, actually, Ljubljana, and that was taken in by the office staff, and I never went back, which was probably not such a nice way to leave, but that was just the way it was, so I decided that's what I'd do. And then I don't know, a couple of years I was doing some supply teaching and I was doing a few other bits and pieces, traveling, doing a lot of cycling, a lot of traveling across Europe, had been to South America before that. And the Kosovo War happened, 1999, roughly. It broke out, I think it was 1999. And out of the blue, I got a phone call from an organization based in Canterbury to ask, I don't know how they got my name, I have no idea, I never ever found out, but they asked me if I'd be prepared to drive a convoy vehicle to Kosovo with aid, because the war was, as everybody knows, it was a long time ago, it was very vicious in Kosovo, the Serbs and the Albanian Muslims were being attacked, the Serbs were actually doing a lot of the attacking, and both sides were entrenched in warfare. And the people were suffering very badly. Villages were being burned and some terrible things, as happened also in the Bosnian War before that. Although I wasn't involved with aid work in that particular confrontation. So I decided, okay, I would. I didn't know quite what to expect. I didn't know whether it would be dangerous or not dangerous, but I just thought, why not? And I drove a vehicle out with a convoy to Kosovo. It was a very difficult time. The war was still just going on, although they were desperately trying to get peace agreements going. And then, of course, the UK government decided to bomb Belgrade, which more or less ended the war. But there was still, where I was positioned, up in the north in Mitrovica, there was still a lot of shelling going on. So it was an interesting time, not having been in an area where there was shelling ever before and rifles firing at night over the river into our areas. We delivered the convoy, we delivered the stuff to the people who needed it and people who'd lost everything, and then drove back to the UK. But somebody, I'd met somebody there who said, look, can you come back out? Because we have an organization working here in Mitrovica which desperately needs volunteer help. That was in the November of 99, and in the February of 2000, I went out again with a van that somebody had lent me full of stuff and drove up north to Mitrovica by myself, actually, which was a bit tricky. And I stayed in Mitrovica and I met this organization up there who were reconstructing Albanian villages from the shelling and the burning and trying to give people back some shelter. Big job, very big job, funded by the EU. And I joined them and then I was there for 3 months. And that was the start of my aid working life, really, as a volunteer. So
that's
I've always been a volunteer.
Was it? Interesting. Knowing you, I can see why somebody would contact you in the first place. But how fascinating that, well, I wonder where they got your name from.
I don't know where it came from. I think I'd been writing some, I can't remember what, it was definitely through some contact I had that I'd met doing something in that 2 year period. Somebody had contacted this organization in Canterbury because they were involved with it and said, look, I know somebody will come out and you know, you're short of drivers. I bet I know somebody will do it, called Maggie. And I guess that's how it happened. Mm. But that's all I can imagine happened anyway. So that was it. 3 months in the north of Kosovo as the war sort of died down and reconstructing and trying to help people and build houses and deliver shelter in the high mountain villages. So that was the start of it. And I carried on working there over the next couple of years. And then in 2003, the organization called Edinburgh Direct Aid, which is the one I now work for, they asked me whether I'd be prepared to front a project working in the West Bank. The situation in the West Bank was getting ever more difficult. The occupation by Israel. Villages were being cut off from other villages. They'd started to build the new Israeli wall, and we were taking medical supplies to clinics that couldn't access the main towns. So I went out to liaise with the Israeli army, which was another very challenging job, and prepare for that. And then the rest of the team came out. Again, another very challenging, very sad, very distressing, very anger-inducing job, because I went out thinking, well, the Israelis, you know, they have suffered a lot of suicide bombs. This is during the period when the Palestinians and Hamas and everybody was, you know, there were suicide bombs going, you know, quite frequently, bombs going off in buses in Israel. And of course, you know, that was appalling. But on the other hand, the West Bank Palestinians were being denied access to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem, to lots of places. And so I felt sorry for both sides, but for my first 24 hours in the West Bank, trying to get into the West Bank through the main checkpoint at Ramallah, and I saw how people were treated. And I'm afraid I realised where my loyalties began to lie from there, because what I saw go on was very distressing, really, for people.
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because the everyday normal people who are affected by it.
Yes, exactly.
And not the same people, no. The people who are in power controlling
no,
it.
No, nothing like, no.
Different groups of people.
Completely different
That's
groups.
Where it gets yeah. very difficult, I think, yeah. working out sort of where your sympathies lie, because it's very emotive, isn't it?
Very
when
emotive.
You're dealing with ordinary people.
Yes, I mean, you have ordinary Israelis being killed. Mm. Of course, on buses. And I mean, at that time, if I was driving in Jerusalem, I was always told, do not drive behind a bus, because the risk was very high at that time. Sometimes you couldn't avoid it. But
and how terrifying for
yeah,
for
and very yeah, absolutely,
like
very terrifying. But then you began to see what was going on and why the Palestinians were reacting like that. And it was out of just desperation, because then I got involved in, well, I pretended to be a journalist, actually, but I was attending a lot of the peaceful rallies to try and stop the olive groves being destroyed for the wall, to stop the wall preventing access to the farmers' fields. You know, farmers, Palestinian farmers who'd been working their fields and their olive groves for hundreds and hundreds of years, and old farmers who would sit, I saw them sit down in the field and cry as bulldozers moved
just
in.
Just slice through them.
Army bulldozers it? Just moving in. And it's very difficult to stay impartial when you see the suffering of people. I didn't see any bus bombing, so I didn't see the aftermath of a bus bombing, which of course would be horrendous.
And of course, that's not the impact of the ordinary people
no.
in Palestine anyway.
No, it's
is it?
Not. No, it's not. And
that's not the farmer who's
no,
sitting down in his
no, that's
olive
right.
field doing that.
No, no, because if they'd been able to access their land as they'd always been able to and carry on with their, and not have these new settlements, which of course were settling into the West Bank, which was meant to be the land for the Palestinians. It's a very complicated situation, but settlements were growing up everywhere, Israeli settlements. They were a group of very right-wing Israelis would go up to some hilltop on the West Bank and they'd start to build their, you know, simple wooden shelters, and they'd say, this is Israeli land now. And the army would protect it. So then they'd have a big fence around it and a big wall, and that would cut off another road. The Palestinians couldn't drive on roads, certain roads, to get to places. Gradually, you saw all their freedom being eroded. Not only that, the checkpoints became something like out of, oh, I don't know, out of the Second World War, big wire, you know, big wire fences, loads of barbed wire, big watchtowers and turnstile gates that you had to queue for hours to get through. I mean, I've seen elderly people faint at those checkpoints because they just were, you know, having to wait so long to get home, having been to try and visit somebody in hospital. And so many freedoms going. Anyway, so that was the project we were doing, and we were trying to provide medical stuff to these small outlying clinics that were cut off from even towns like Ramallah and Bethlehem and Jerusalem. So, that was quite an interesting time, but upsetting.
Mm.
Very upsetting, I found that.
Yeah, it must take its toll on you, personally.
Well, it does, because, yes, it does. I mean, the women were incredible. The women would go peacefully to the army lines, you know, because the army would have their Land Rovers lined up, ready to move in with the bulldozers behind them, and the women would go. Because the trouble with the men going, you've got these young men who pick up and throw stones. And you can understand why they wanted to throw stones at the Army Land Rover. A, it was pointless. And B, of course, the army would just fire, rubber bullets and lots of tear gas. I mean, the number of times I got caught up in tear gas was, oh. And once you've had a bad tear gas attack, you never, ever forget it. Horrible. But the women, of course, would go, and the army were much more restrained. And the women would go, and they would talk to the men, talk to the army. And some of the army, you know, there were some members of the Israeli army who were very reasonable and very, you know, as though they looked a bit sad that they were having to do what they were doing. They were following orders. And the women, sometimes the women would turn the bulldozers back. They were more successful in turning the bulldozers back. And I would join those protests with the women. But of course, as a Westerner, I still had to pretend I was a journalist. Otherwise, I would have been not allowed back into Israel.
Have a reason to be there.
Yeah. You can't just, you know, that's what's happened to so many Western protesters out there. They've not been allowed back in. And then you can't do anything. So there was that, yes, that long, distressing period of work there. And then lots and lots and lots of work over the next 10 years. Pakistan earthquake, the tsunami in Sri Lanka.
You go where you're needed, basically.
Where we're asked to go. Mm. I mean, we're only so small, so we get very little funding, so we can't do a great deal, except that when there's a major disaster, the Pakistan earthquake in 2005 was the case in point. Huge Pakistan community in Edinburgh and in Glasgow, where we're based. I live in Yorkshire, but. And when that earthquake struck, I mean, killing 75,000 at a stroke, really, more or less, our office was inundated with requests from wealthy Pakistani families saying, please, can you go? We don't know what's happened to the family here. We don't know what's happening here. Please, can you go? Here's money. We can put in as much money as you need. And we got thousands and thousands of pounds in. So I was sent out to see where the greatest need and what we could best do with this money. And I worked there from 2005 and of course it was terrible, the earthquake. I remember going into a mountain town called Balakot and the stench of dead bodies. I mean, I'd never smelt anything like that. And the destruction, it would look like a nuclear bomb had hit the place. And there were many towns like that. So living conditions were terrible. I was in a tent most of the time. And we were working up in the mountain villages where whole schools and whole villages had been wiped out. They had no shelter. They were sleeping out under winter, Pakistan winter. So it was very urgent. So I went out and was transported from village to village by UN helicopter. Was dropped in with my tent and my gear and maybe another colleague, and we would stay there for maybe a month working. And then the UN would supply us with what we were needing, like stoves, winter stoves or whatever. And that went on. The projects developed. We put clinics in. We put so many things into the villages that had lost everything. They'd lost all their medical clinics.
That's what I like. Having heard your stories over the years, so you get called into that emergency relief situation.
It is emergency relief, yeah.
But then you also work on some projects that are going to have a more long-term,
sustainable
impact.
Yeah. What we never do, Edinburgh Direct Aid, we never just go in, deal with an emergency. We can't deal with an emergency. We're not big enough to deal with an emergency, but we do emergency aid in the places where big agencies don't get to.
Right.
And they don't get often to the sort of, you know, the really little difficult places high up or wherever. And that's where we go. But then we tend to stay there and we tend to develop projects from that, like where most needs a medical clinic. Because all the villages need, they're very highly populated and they all need medical care. So we would start thinking what we used to do. One of the best things we did, we'd send in a big container of aid, a 40-foot, 10-ton, 12-ton container. We'd empty it, distribute the stuff. And then most people would just send the containers back to the port. But I suggested that maybe we could buy the container and we could convert it into a clinic, because it's a big space inside a container. But the problem was getting that as a converted clinic. We could convert it, which we did. I did it with a fireman, a local fireman who came from Edinburgh, and the two of us were out there 2 months converting this container. And then we had to get it flown in to a mountain village at 10,000 feet. I went to the UN and said, look, do you fancy this challenge? Because we've got it here and we can put it somewhere lower, but I know that this particular village, Konkan, really needs it. I've been up there for several months in the tent and it's desperate. So they talked about it, the pilots of the helicopters, great big helicopters they were using. And they said, okay, yeah, we'll do it. The UN said, we'll do it. Why not? So we converted it on the field up in the northern part of Pakistan, unbeknown to us, only about 300 meters from where Osama bin Laden was living.
Wow.
And was later killed by the Americans. But we didn't know he was there. He was in a house next to the airfield. We converted it. And then the day came when the UN were going to airlift it. It was a fine day. I was up in the mountains ready to receive it. Somebody else was down waiting for the helicopter to attach the strops and carry it up over the mountains. Well, it's a story in itself, really. I don't know whether you want me to tell you very briefly the story.
Yeah.
They got it on the strops. They flew it on a pretty windy day up into the mountains at 10,000 feet. All the villagers were waiting to see it, about 1,000 villagers, which we'd kept back up the hill. I was down with a special hand-picked team of local villagers. We'd prepared the base. In came the helicopter. This thing was swaying and spinning in the air, and the helicopter, you could see, was struggling a bit to control anything. And we were waiting for it, and our job was to grab the strops as they came down to try and stabilize it. So we did. We ran onto this narrow terrace and grabbed the strops, brought it down, but the helicopter was spinning and it couldn't control it, so it had to drop it. And we had to release the strops to release the helicopter before it crashed, climbing up onto the top of the thing and crawling on our stomachs to release those strops off the top of the roof of the container. But unfortunately, it dropped it with the door jammed against the side of the mountain. So all the 2 months of converting it, we couldn't even get in it. And it was absolutely, well, I was at my lowest ebb at that point and sat down and had my head in my hands. I just thought, all that work, all that money, and not that it costs so much, but, and suddenly I looked up the hillside and 1,000 villagers were rushing down the hillside like Zulu and said, "Don't worry, Maggie, you relax, you stay there, we'll move it." And of course, over the next 5 hours, they got levers, they got planks of wood, and millimetre by millimetre, they moved it back onto its base until we could open all the doors and everything was absolutely fine. That was a tremendous memory I have of just how badly the villagers wanted their clinic and how much they were prepared to do and how hard they were prepared to work, and when I was at the point of giving up, really.
I think it's also a good illustration of the relationships you develop, because as you mentioned before, yes, you go into these places, but then you stay a while and you develop these relationships, and it must become, you know, a challenge that you want to achieve because you've made these relationships.
Exactly. You
goes beyond just
it
the
goes
job.
Beyond that. You invest in the village and you invest in the people, and they get to know you and you know them and you know what they need and what they want. And yeah, like, absolutely, you're right. You build up a very close relationship with people, and are people I'm still in contact with in that village, actually, because the clinic is functioning. It's a vaccination centre now, delivering babies. And later that year, I delivered a baby myself up there.
Wow.
When I was up there very late at night, and, you know, I was needed. The midwife couldn't cope on her own. She was needed somebody there to help. There was no light. The light had failed. Times like that, you realise just how important that clinic was and still is. Yeah, it was good. And we did other things, water systems, new pipe systems for the villages.
And the conditions you're often living in where you're there.
Oh,
I know,
camping,
you've told stories
tent.
Of bed bugs and fleas and all sorts of
the fleas. The fleas were one of my real worst things. I did everything to avoid the fleas, but it was impossible. They just were everywhere. And, you know, you'd go into some of the houses and, you know, to have some of their milky tea on a cold winter's day, and you'd sit on their... They were in their blankets. I mean, they're immune to them, but of course they loved me. And I, every now and again, I'd have to go down to Islamabad to deflea and wash my clothes and try and get some ointment for the bites. And oh, terrible, terrible.
It's the kind
time.
Of thing that could tip you over the edge,
oh,
isn't it?
Easily.
When you're dealing with those levels of stress.
Easily.
It's just the kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
That, no, I can't do it anymore.
Scratching yourself to death up there in the tent at night. Oh, horrible. And, you know, there was nothing to be done. I had flea powder everywhere, which is pretty toxic, actually, stuff that you shouldn't really have. Mm. But I didn't care at the time. I'd have bathed in it. I'd have swallowed it. I'd have done anything to get rid of them. So there were many, many interesting years in Pakistan and other projects. And then flooding. We had flooding emergencies, and I was up. I was back out for the flooding, and then I was back out to put another clinic in, and one we built this time ourselves, and landslides, caught in landslides, so many landslides, and some very dodgy times, really, when I look back on it. It makes my spine shiver now when I think what I, you know, what I got away with, really. And I think I was very lucky. I mean, I have absolutely not a religious cell in my body. I think I was extremely lucky to get away with what I got away with. And, you know, other people didn't. Some of our villagers lost their lives going over the track, you know, up to the village where the clinic was. Their vehicle got swept over by landslides. But I was never in a vehicle that happened to. You know, we always managed to just stop suddenly before the landslide hit and reverse. Things like that.
Well, I know you've been in places where you've been ducking down low to avoid the crossfire and all sorts
of
things.
Yeah, well, that happened in Kosovo. One time we had to dive in between a load of big lorries because they were shooting across and trying to sniper at the soldiers.
Where was the place you ended up? I remember you telling me the story where you were ill on the plane.
Oh,
and
yes.
You ended up on this great long trek, sort of semi-conscious.
Yeah. I was hijacked by some Kosovan Albanians who were smuggling arms into Kosovo. I think they were part of the Kosovo Liberation Army. I was on the plane and we'd landed. I'm very, very sick if the plane is turbulent coming down. And I was so ill, I was virtually unconscious. And I got to the queue. They carried me, these four men carried me to the queue for the passports, took my passport out of my bag. And I was carrying a lot of money, stuffed down my bra, stuffed down my knickers, everywhere I was carrying money. They took the passport and they got me through immigration, and somebody was supposed to be meeting me outside, but I didn't know who it was, somebody from the organization. But these four chaps just threw me in a car. Well, didn't throw me in a car. They put me in a car and I was so ill. Had all my bag and my money and everything. And they took me through the UN border. And because I was a Westerner, I think I was probably very useful to them. Because they kept saying, this woman's ill, we've got to get her. I mean, I was vaguely aware of that. And in the middle of the night, we drove through the night. I don't know where we were going. And I ended up in some remote farmhouse somewhere in the middle of Kosovo. I don't know where it was. And I was so ill, I didn't care. And I was put into bed with three children who were all asleep by this time. I don't know what time of the morning it was. And I went to sleep. I just slept. And then I woke up in the morning and I woke up sometime in that day and I felt a lot better. And I thought, oh my God, where am I? Where's all the money? Where's my passport? Where's my bag? Where is my luggage? Where's everything? It must have gone. And I sat up and I got out of the bed. And at the bottom of the bed was every single possession I came in with that they'd put there. All the money, my passport, everything. And then within the hour, they'd given me some breakfast and taken me up to Mitrovica where I was working. So there you go, you see. I mean, it could have been so much worse. Mm. How did I know? And I didn't care. I really didn't care. I just wanted to die. So one has to have faith in mankind, I guess.
Maybe that helped in a way that you were so out of it.
Maybe. Well, yes, otherwise I'd have wondered what the hell was going on, I think. And I'd have thought, well, you know, they would have taken money. Because I do remember vaguely that night they were unloading stuff from the boot and we were stopped at an army checkpoint and they were looking in with a torch, the army. This is UN troops, peacekeeping. And I know these chaps were taken out and were frisked and I don't know how they got away with it. I wasn't really compassmentous enough to know. Yes, that was another interesting experience. I'd forgotten about that.
And you were in Greece for a time, weren't you, with the...
When the Syrian refugees were coming across in the rafts, in their hundreds a day, or thousands in a day. Yes, I spent 2 weeks there. That was very distressing too. Very distressing. The height of the Syrian war. Little kids, little babies, and the rafts would break, the engine would break down, and you'd have to run into the water as they were coming in, and they couldn't get in, and you had to pull them in. And then you had to get them from some remote beach to some help centre. And I hadn't gone out to do that particular job. I'd gone out with some money to offer it to some of the Greek organisation that we were working with. But I ended up, I had this little tiny hire car and I was driving this little hire car over beaches and tracks and mountain roads, stuffed full of wet, drowning Syrian refugees. And I don't know how many I managed to cram in my car each time because they were wet, they needed help. I was passing babies in through the window. Then I had about three in the front with me, this tiny car. And I would drive them to a shelter and then I'd just go straight back down again for the next rafts coming in. Yeah, that was very distressing, actually.
I think so often we're so disconnected from the reality, the real human reality of what's going on. And it's just the immigrants as this group.
That's right.
Immigrants,
exactly.
refugees.
They
just become
this amorphous group with long clothes, half drowned.
Exactly. And there's something we don't want.
No,
labelled
by
certain journalists as cockroaches.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Why are they coming here?
But for you, you must, and anyone who watches the news can't fail to be hit emotionally by those pictures bodies washed up on
that's
beaches.
Right. Little children.
You know, but for you, it must have been so overwhelming to be there in the thick
of it. I mean, the thing about that job, and I suppose the thing about my job, is that you are so busy and you're so focused and you have to think of the next thing you're going to do that you don't allow yourself time to think, God, this is terrible. I can't do this. Oh, I have to get away from here. I can't bear to see another half-drowned baby coming ashore crying for its mother and there's no mother because the mother's in some other boat or the mother's don't know what's happened to the mother. You can't stop to think. You just have to act all the time. And I suppose that's what I've always done. And I certainly did in that situation. And you're right about the refugees, because people, just so many people who don't experience them close at hand, fleeing from some terrible, the shelling in Syria was just ongoing all the time. And but they are teachers, they're doctors, they're nurses, they're IT consultants, they're engineers. The ones I was bringing ashore, they were all, you know, skilled people. They were all, you know, not all, of course, not all were highly skilled people, but so many were skilled people. But of course, what gave it also a bad reputation was there's also a lot of Africans coming in from Afghanistan. Well, not Africans, from Afghanistan, actually, I meant, but there were Africans too. So they were mixed in with the Syrians. And so, you know, this became a bit of a problem because people were saying, well, what, the Afghanistan, why are they coming in? But they were fleeing. Terrible, terrible war going on, and still in Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban were blowing people up and attacking everybody, and, you know, they were caught in the middle of it. And they have no hope, these people, these young people. They want, Europe was their big dream. Well, I mean, I don't think it turned out to be so good for so many of them, but.
But they're often this tiny minority. I mean, maybe there are a few people who are doing it for some kind of choice of economical reasons, but I can't think how...
Economic migrants, yeah. I mean, there were a lot of those, but most of them were fleeing conflict.
Yeah, but, you know, the tiny minority, but they were all made to be, this is the majority. They're just coming, it's their choice, or, you know, they're terrorists or
right.
whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
But actually, the majority are just very normal people. Mm-hmm. Desperate to try
and get some sort of better life for their families. You know, it was the children that were the driving force for these parents, and they couldn't foresee any future for them, and they could only foresee death or hopelessness.
Yeah, because you're not going to put your kids through that.
No, you're not. You're not going to put. No, you're
desperate.
Not. You're not going to take on that journey and pay all that money. I mean, the ones that really need, I mean, the smugglers were obviously scurrilous. Mm. I saw them in Turkey, actually, when I was in Turkey, and they would do anything to get money out of the refugees. And the Syrians, you know, they had quite a lot of money. In Syria, the life had been quite good at a certain level, and they had money, and they were bringing their money. And, of course, nearly all of that went to these smuggling groups, as it still does, actually. We see it now happening from Libya, of course, but that was another very, I keep using the word distressing. There isn't really another word to use, because when you see people in those situations, whether they're Palestinians in the West Bank having their olive groves torn down, or they're Syrian refugees trying to get into Europe through the Greek route to Lesbos, or Pakistani people in Kashmir after the earthquake sleeping out under the open with aftershocks all the time and screaming. It's all distressing, of course. Always distressing.
They're just people.
They're just people, absolutely. They're just people like everybody else. I mean, that's right.
And how do you acclimatise going from that to coming back home?
Well, that's always difficult. The coming home is always difficult. Very difficult, I find. I get used to it after a while, but I don't find the first couple of weeks very easy. I always find I don't relate to people, because people will come up and say, you know, friends will come up and say, oh, you know, you had a difficult time there. What was it like? You know, and they're happy to talk for 15 minutes maybe. And then it's, well, you know, he hasn't got a job yet. This son of mine, or he hasn't got this. I don't know what to do about this. And you think,
everything must pale into
insignificance. But it's a bit unfair on everybody, because, I mean, for everybody, you know, what's going on in their lives is very important. So you have to try and understand that. So I do try hard, but sometimes it's a bit difficult, you know. I suppose I've got used to it now, really. And Lebanon has been particularly difficult. You know, the Lebanon-Syrian border, where I've been working since 2014. That's been our main focus, really, as you know. And that's difficult because it's been very dangerous. Very dangerous through 2015-16. Again, I think I was very lucky to get away with that. I was tagged, as they say, a few times by the militants, because I was a prime target for kidnapping. But never gung-ho. I mean, you know, people say, oh, it's a bit gung-ho to be there when, you know, well, everybody else had, all the other organisations had dropped out of the border town because of the risk, because the Islamic State were there and al-Nusra. They'd taken over the town. But, you know, we did stay in and work, but I could only stay there for, well, maximum would have been a week, but I stayed 12 days once, and I think I was probably very lucky to get away with that. And several times I had to come out after 2 days. And I was so protected by the Syrian team around me. They kept me safe, really. Without them, I don't know what would have happened. But we got a lot of work done. And worth the risk? Well, yeah, I would say worth the risk. But other people would say, well, you're stupid. You know, that would have been stupid. If they got hold of you as a bargaining chip, that would have been bad. And it would, of course. But we balanced the risk very carefully beforehand, very carefully. And so it wasn't gung-ho. It was a very considered, managed risk. But that risk is now more or less gone, and it's much safer there now. But now we have other pressures. And this year has been with climate, well, who knows if it's climate change, but the weather this winter has been horrendous, the worst ever weather they've had. So I've been out there 3 times for emergency weather-related work, and then I've just come back from political pressure on the Syrians to be sent back to Syria, which would be a disaster for them. And so they've been destroying the shelters. The army have moved in to destroy their homes, their shelter homes, and so we've had to try and help with that work.
I saw a post recently that you put up on Facebook, something about they had to reduce the height.
That's right.
To be allowed to
new
keep
rules
them. It
came
just
in.
Seemed
yeah.
crazy.
Crazy.
I mean, is that basically just an excuse to get rid of them?
Yes, it is. It's pressure on them to go. Mm. And it's just only in our town have they done that at the moment, where there's about 60,000 refugees. Because over the last 3 years, the refugees have tried to weatherproof their shelters. So they built cheap cement walls around or put cheap cement roof on because they've needed to. That doesn't mean they want to stay in Lebanon. The last thing they want to do is stay in Lebanon. But the government decided that anything with cement was a permanent structure, and they do not want them there as a permanent presence. So they, this stupid rule, how everything had to come down to 1 meter in height. So the army said, if you don't do it, then we're going to move in with bulldozers and you'll lose everything. Well, how could the disabled, of which there are many, how could the elderly start to demolish their cement homes? You need lump hammers and you need pneumatic drills and, you know, they're all reinforced with steel rods. So we got a team of Syrians together that we trained already in construction. We do a lot of training in construction, ready for their return. And they got all the skills, and we put a team of 15 together with our manager, Nabil, and they went to the worst camps. The UN asked us to go to the camps for the disabled and the children's camps and the widows' camps and do managed demolition, which was knock it down without destroying their water systems and their sewage and their possessions. So that's what we were doing. And then rebuilding with cheap, nasty, UN-supplied plastic sheeting and wood. So come this next winter, when the snow comes, as it will, heavy, those shelters will collapse.
Must be very frustrating.
Very frustrating, yeah. We knew we were building shelters that would not withstand the next winter or the next storm, really. And the weather is changing there. The climate is changing. So they won't be very warm, whereas the cement shelters were much warmer. So we don't know what will happen there. But at least we, you know, and that was so distressing that time. You know, elderly people would come to me and say, we'd rather die. We'd rather die than have this happen to us, have our home destroyed now. We might as well die. We can't go back to Syria. We can't. They don't want us here. And it's true. You know, what do they do? And the disabled who didn't understand, a lot of the mentally disabled didn't understand what was happening. They suddenly saw their home had gone. And so that's still ongoing. The team is still working on that, still reconstructing. So yes, it's been a very busy year this year.
And tell us a little bit, just briefly, about how Edinburgh Direct Aid work, because I know you've explained to me before that it's a very different structure from a lot of the bigger charities.
Well, it's entirely voluntary. So we have a warehouse team in Edinburgh that works very hard filling the 40-foot containers, because we send out 2 or 3 containers a year with clothing, with sewing machines, with looms, with material, with wool, with many things for women's workshops and for clothing, for the children, sports clothing, toys, many things, basic medical supplies, although we're not allowed to take in much medical. They're all volunteers. The whole team is volunteers. So we have a treasurer and we have a fundraiser, two fundraisers, and we have the chairman who is 91 years old and still running 10 kilometres to raise funding for us. And it's just run as a sort of a big family, really. And then I'm their main field person that goes out. But sometimes other people do go out, but I'm obviously their chief sort of field officer. So that's how it's run, just purely on volunteer basis.
But what that means on a practical level is that people who donate, all that money gets used.
Yeah, all that money goes to...
Rather than one of the bigger charities,
yes,
where
right.
a big chunk of that,
yeah,
presumably, I have no idea what kind of percentage.
No,
that goes
no,
on wages
right. no.
and all sorts of things.
No, there's a few stories about that, but I won't go into that, but... No, that's right. I don't know what our percentage that goes straight to the beneficiaries is. It's very high because also we try. I mean, I can't always fund my own expenses for travel because I'm out there so often. Mm. I can't, but I do when I can because I don't have much of an income really. But others that go out, like we have a retired doctor and Dennis himself, who's a retired mathematician, and some others who do occasionally go out. Everything is funded by them for them. You know, they nothing comes out of the funding. It's all personal expenses that they pay themselves. So that is very different to how most organisations would work. And of course, we don't. There's no salaries or anything. We don't get paid anything. You know, it costs me some money during the year to go out, but I do get some of that back because I can't simply afford to keep doing it. So, I mean, 4-5 times I've been out this year. So you've got flights to Beirut and, yeah, that's how it works.
So it's a small charity, but yeah. relatively speaking, has a big impact.
Big punch, really. Mm-hmm. I'd say we have a fairly big punch for such a small charity. And somehow the money just keeps coming in. I mean, it's endless fundraising events that are very hard work. I mean, I don't do the fundraise. I do talks, do a lot of talks, but I mean, I'm not big on the fundraising side. And I think that's just as hard a job as what I have to do when I go out to the Syrian border. I mean, fundraising is a nightmare. And we just rely on regular donors, some businesses, sometimes Scottish Government give us some money. I mean, we have a very good reputation. I think that's how we keep the money coming in.
Yeah.
So long may that continue.
Well, thank you for sharing some of your stories. Like I say, I've wanted to share them for a long time.
Right.
So when I heard you were here, I grabbed the opportunity.
Yeah, it was a good opportunity. Oh, I'm having my little relaxing holiday here now. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's nice to tell the story, really. It's nice to tell the story of what we do.
And so what might be a top tip that you could share with our listeners? It can be anything you like.
Well, I suppose in the end it would be what I've always said, even when I wasn't aid working, when I was on my year-long trip around South America and getting into all sorts of scrapes there and difficulties and Tiananmen Square, you know, and the massacre, I got caught in that. So many things. It would be that no matter how bad things are, somebody somewhere will come along and help you out. Always somebody will be there to help you out. So you've just got to have faith that will happen. Just when you think there is nothing that's going to get any better and you don't know what to do and you're really stuck, somebody comes along. There's always a solution, usually from another person or people. So I would say that's probably my top tip. Always think something will come along, and it does.
And you did mention earlier that you have just this underlying faith in humanity that is probably maybe what's helped you get through some of those sticky situations.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even talking to a member of Islamic State once by chance, and I didn't know he was. And I mean, very fluent English speaker, protecting his family, was going back to Syria to die. But I mean, we had a really interesting, nice conversation. Not that I'm supporting in any way what Islamic State do, because they're grim, terrible. But, I mean, maybe he was just a slightly different version of that, you see. So, yeah, faith in humanity always. I think we have to have that. Definitely.
Well, thank you very much, Maggie.
Okay.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowomen. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's quote is from Warson Shire. Well, actually, it's two quotes because I couldn't choose between them. In fact, they are both from a poem called Home, which you should read because it's brilliant. I was tempted to read the whole thing out, actually, but I've put a link in the show notes instead. No one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.